The storm hit with apocalyptic fury. Within minutes, the clear summit views disappeared into a whiteout as hurricane-force winds transformed the South Col into a death trap. Climbers who had just stood triumphantly on Everest's summit now stumbled blindly, oxygen-starved and hypothermic, desperately trying to find their tents just a few hundred yards away. It was May 10, 1996, and one of mountaineering's deadliest days was unfolding. 8 climbers would perish in a single 24-hour period. John Krakauer, a journalist-turned-client on Rob Hall's expedition, had safely reached camp minutes before the storm hit. He had no idea that his teammates were still out there, fighting for their lives in temperatures plunging below minus 40 F. By morning, the devastating truth would emerge. The mountain had claimed some of the world's most experienced guides, including Krakauer's own expedition leader. What drives people to risk everything for a few moments on Earth's highest point? And what happens when ambition, commercialization, and nature's indifference collide at 29,000 feet? Everest wasn't always commercial. After being identified as Earth's highest peak in 1852, it represented exploration's ultimate challenge, claiming 24 lives before Hillary and Norgay's 1953 summit. Everything changed in 1985 when businessman Dick Bass summited with guide David Brashears, proving Everest was accessible to anyone with sufficient money and determination. By 1996, guided expeditions had transformed the mountain. 30 teams crowded the slopes that season, with clients paying up to $65,000 for their summit attempt. This commercialization brought people with limited high-altitude experience to one of Earth's deadliest environments. Krakauer exemplified this contradiction. Though an accomplished climber, he was 41, overweight, and lacked high-altitude experience. When Outside magazine asked him to report on Everest's commercialization, he proposed climbing it himself, despite the grim statistics. Historically, Everest had killed 1 climber for every 4 who reached the summit. "I knew better, but went anyway," Krakauer admits, becoming party to good people's deaths, something that will burden my conscience for years. Base camp at 17,600 feet resembled a small village. Over 300 tents housing 14 expeditions across a boulder-strewn glacier. Commercial expeditions offered surprising comforts. Solar power, satellite communications, hot showers, and fresh food delivered by yaks. Yet these amenities couldn't mask the physical deterioration already beginning. At extreme altitude, the body consumes itself. Krakauer developed a persistent cough. Wounds wouldn't heal, and his appetite vanished. His limbs withered while sleep became elusive. He'd wake gasping for breath, his oxygen-starved brain triggering panic responses. The route required navigating the Khumbu Icefall, a maze of shifting, building-sized ice blocks that had claimed 19 lives since 1963. Climbers crossed bottomless crevasses on wobbly aluminum ladders, constantly buckling from glacier movement. Higher at Camp 2, 21,300 feet, Krakauer felt like he had a raging red wine hangover. While exploring, he discovered a corpse, just the lower half of a body. Passing climbers barely acknowledged such grim reminders, as if agreeing to ignore what was truly at stake. As summit day approached, warning signs multiplied. Tensions flared between expedition leaders over rope-fixing duties. The South African expedition became a scandal. Their leader had fabricated credentials, while some team members couldn't even attach crampons properly. "With so many incompetent people on the mountain," Rob Hall observed, "I think it's pretty unlikely that we'll get through this season without something bad happening up high." His prediction materialized when the Wang Tapche, one of Fisher Sherpas, developed high-altitude pulmonary edema. Cultural misunderstandings delayed his evacuation until after cardiac arrest. Sherpas attributed his condition to someone angering Sagar Matha through sexual activity on the mountain. Despite these crises, climbers remained fixated on summit dreams. Hall emphasized adhering to predetermined turnaround times, 1 or 2 p.m. at the latest. On May 9th, 15 members of Hall's team began ascending before midnight, followed by Fisher's and Makalu-Gao's teams, 33 climbers total. The night climb had ethereal beauty under moonlight. Problems emerged early. Frank Fischbeck turned back. Doug Hansen stepped aside but later rejoined. Fisher Sirdar Lopsong was exhausted from short roping Sandy Pittman upward. Overwhelmed by apprehension about the descent, Krakauer took only 4 quick summit photos before descending. Martin Adams recognized innocent-looking clouds below as dangerous thunderheads and quickly departed. By 6:45 p.m., scattered climbers had formed a single group from both expeditions. Though within 200 vertical feet of Camp 4, the storm intensified into a hurricane with visibility under 20 feet. Despite being only 1,000 horizontal feet from safety, they wandered for hours before stopping at the edge of a 7,000-foot drop. With wind chill exceeding 100 below zero, they huddled behind a boulder. 4 climbers, including Charlotte Fox and Yasuko Namba, became too weak to move. Around midnight, a brief clearing revealed their position, and stronger climbers left for help. Rob Hall remained stranded high with Doug Hansen, who had summited dangerously late. Throughout the night, Hall made desperate radio calls. By morning, Hansen was dead, and Hall perished after a final satellite call to his pregnant wife, "I love you. Sleep well, my sweetheart." Scott Fisher died at 27,200 feet with empty oxygen. Miraculously, Beck Weathers, after lying exposed for 12 hours, walked into Camp 4 despite being nearly blind and severely frostbitten. 6 months after Nepal, Krakauer remained haunted by Everest, unable to go hours without thinking about the expedition. Even his dreams offered no escape. The tragedy continued after Hall's team left. By season's end, 12 climbers had died, including Lopsang Jongbu, who perished in a September avalanche while guiding, leaving behind a wife and infant. Everest tragedy poisoned lives beyond those lost. Relationships collapsed, depression hospitalized one victim's wife, and teammates struggled with their marriages and careers. Neil Beidelman, who helped save 5 clients, remains haunted by Yasuko Namba's death. During a brief clearing in the storm, he tried helping her. "She grabbed my arm, but was too weak. I can still feel her fingers sliding across my biceps, then letting go." Despite the tragedy, the mountain's 1996 fatality rate was actually slightly below the historical 3.3%, cold comfort to survivors grappling with their continued existence. What drives us to risk everything for a summit indifferent to our dreams? Climbing Everest isn't about thrill-seeking, but an almost Calvinistic undertaking of suffering and endurance. Most climbers seek something like a state of grace through their ordeal. Commercialization has created dangerous pressures for guides to reach the summit regardless of conditions. In the death zone, even the strongest guides become powerless when things go wrong. Mountaineers often abandon good judgment when the summit beckons. The mountain remains indifferent, its slopes marked by frozen bodies of those who misjudged its power. Yet each year, hundreds more arrive, drawn by the same call. Everest's greatest lesson concerns our limitations. In a world where technology and money seemingly overcome any obstacle, the mountain reminds us that nature still holds the upper hand. We climb not to conquer it, but because testing ourselves against its implacable face reveals our humanity, our courage, folly, and humility before greater forces.